Hello and welcome back to The Fall of the Roman Empire. It's Nick Holmes and this is episode 64 called The Fire Ships. In the last episode, we heard how the German warlord Ricimer, the virtual king of Italy, held the real power in the West after Majorian's death. He made and unmade emperors at his will. In 465, his puppet emperor Libius Severus died. No one had taken much notice of him when he lived, and no one took much notice when he died. Now Ricimer pondered what to do. Was it really worth appointing another stooge as emperor? The truth was that Libius Severus hadn't helped his claim to legitimacy at all. The Roman generals in Gaul and Dalmatia, Syagrius and Marcellinus, were itching to depose him, and the man who wanted to remove him most of all was Gaiseric, king of the Vandals. So he decided not to appoint an emperor, and for the next 18 months, there was no emperor in the West. That is, until finally, in 467, the Eastern Emperor Leo turned his gaze towards the West. For most of the 460s, Leo had been too preoccupied with the Ostrogoths and Huns along the Danube frontier and the Persians in the East to take much notice of the Western Empire's plight. But change was afoot. The Eastern Roman army was getting stronger as it reduced its dependence on German mercenaries, which was the Achilles heel of the Western Empire, and recruited more native troops, especially Isaurians from Cilicia. In 466 and 67, it won victories over the Ostrogoths and the Huns. And in 467, something else happened. Gaiseric, king of the Vandals, provoked the wrath of Leo. Let's take a step back for a moment and consider the extraordinary career of Gaiseric. For in 467, Gaiseric was the grand old man of late antiquity. He was at least 75 years old and had been king for nearly 40 years. He'd always craved legitimacy since his mother had been a slave and he was the illegitimate son of the Vandal king Godegisel. The Gothic historian Jordanes described him thus, quote, "Gaiseric was a man of moderate height and lame in consequence of a fall from his horse. He was a man of deep thought and few words, holding luxury in disdain, furious in his anger, greedy for gain, shrewd in winning over the barbarians, and skilled in sowing the seeds of dissension to arouse enmity." End quote. A visionary, he had led the Vandals across the Straits of Gibraltar and into Africa to create the Vandal kingdom in the sun. His proudest moment had been when his son Huneric married the Roman princess Eudocia when she was taken to Carthage after the sack of Rome in 455. She had rapidly given birth to their son Hilderic, who now in 468 had a theoretically legitimate claim to the Western throne, although no one was willing to recognise a 12-year-old boy who was half Vandal and half Roman. But Gaiseric would do anything to further his claim on the Western throne, and if his grandson wasn't going to be recognised, then the next best thing was recognition for his mother's sister, the Princess Placidia, who he had also abducted from Rome. And in 462, he did a deal with the Eastern Emperor Leo to release Placidia to go to Constantinople to marry a Roman senator named Olybrius. He then appealed to Leo to make Olybrius Western Emperor. But Leo wouldn't listen. In the years after 462, Gaiseric put pressure on Ricimer to accept Olybrius as the Western Emperor. He raided the Italian coastline. He occupied Sicily and Sardinia. How long would it be before he sailed to Rome and put Olybrius on the throne himself? But Ricimer wouldn't budge. He wasn't going to take orders from a Vandal-appointed emperor. In reality, the only man who could put Olybrius on the throne was the Eastern Emperor Leo. Unfortunately for Gaiseric, Leo wasn't remotely interested in backing Olybrius, and finally, in 467, Geiseric made a terrible mistake. His frustration boiled over, and he ordered a Vandal raid on Greece, which was, of course, part of the Eastern Empire. Leo was not cowed into submission, just the opposite. He was furious, so furious, that he decided the time was now right to put an end to the Vandals once and for all. And Leo's first step was to appoint an emperor in the west. Taking no notice of Geiseric and Olybrius, in the spring of 467 he named Anthemius western emperor. Anthemius came from a distinguished family and had proved himself a capable general fighting for Marcian on the Danube front. He'd even been a candidate for the eastern throne when the emperor Marcian died. Indeed, Leo may have been rewarding him for supporting him as emperor. There was, of course, the small matter of Ricimer, the virtual king of Italy. Leo had no time for Ricimer. Instead, he preferred the Roman general Marcellinus, the governor of Dalmatia, one of Ricimer's fiercest opponents. So he ordered Marcellinus to march with Anthemius to Rome. But he didn't depose Ricimer. He made Marcellinus joint Patricius with him. And as a peace offering, Anthemius offered Ricimer his daughter, Olypia, in marriage. We have no record of who Ricimer was married to previously, if anyone. The poet and chronicler Sidonius enjoyed observing that Olypia didn't seem to be delighted by her betrothal to Ricimer, and the marriage produced no children. But this Game of Thrones in the West was of little real interest to Leo. He had a much bigger plan. The East was going to reconquer the West. In 467, he mustered one of the largest invasion forces in Roman history. We have various sources for this, and they are all agreed on one point, the huge scale of the expedition. Priscus, the chronicler and the man who'd had dinner with Attila long ago in 449, recorded the expedition, although this source hasn't survived. Instead, the 6th century chronicler Procopius has left us with a detailed account of the story based on the facts provided by Priscus. Procopius describes a staggeringly large expedition from the east. Leo gathered a great armada of 1,100 ships. This was nearly four times the size of Majorian's fleet that Geiseric destroyed in 461. Yet the figure seems plausible, since the Eastern Empire was certainly at least four times as wealthy as the dilapidated Western Empire. Procopius also says 100,000 soldiers were mustered. This is almost certainly an exaggeration. Most historians think the army was probably about half Procopius's number, at around 50,000 men. Although even that would have been an immense force and around the size of the Western coalition that Aetius formed to fight Attila at the Battle of the Catalaunian Plains in 451. It's worth noting that Procopius, who is most famous for his detailed history of the reign of Justinian, probably somewhat exaggerated the size of Leo's expedition in 468 to show Belisarius's later expedition against the Vandals in a better light. As we'll hear in a later episode, Belisarius was the general who defeated the Vandals in 533 with a smaller army than Leo sent in 468. So returning to 468, Leo's expedition was huge, and not surprisingly, the cost to the Eastern Roman treasury was said to be gigantic at £130,000 of gold, equivalent, for example, to nearly 62 years of annual tribute to Attila. The success of the invasion was crucially important to Leo. He meticulously worked out the plan of campaign. The main fleet would sail to Sicily and thence to Carthage. Marcellinus and his Dalmatian troops were to secure the island from the Vandals prior to the fleet's arrival, as well as ridding Sardinia of the Vandals. A third force, recruited from the army of Egypt, led by the eastern general Heraclius, was to be transported to Tripolis in modern-day Libya and would march along the Mediterranean coastline towards Carthage, taking the towns that had fallen to the Vandals along the way. But our chronicler Procopius was keen to point out that within this huge organisation there was a fatal flaw. Leo gave overall command of the entire operation to his brother-in-law, the general Basiliscus. While Basiliscus had just recently defeated a resurgent Hunnic threat along the Danube led by the remaining two of Attila's sons, and had therefore proved himself a competent general, Procopius claims he had designs on the throne himself and wanted to discredit Leo. Procopius says he was in league with the Gothic general Aspar against Leo. Historians have never known quite how to interpret this view. The obvious hole in Procopius's argument is that if the expedition failed, Basiliscus would look just as much of a dummy as Leo. Because of this, most people dismiss it as a conspiracy theory. Instead, they favour the argument that Leo was controlled by his formidable wife, Verina, who simply wished to promote her brother, Basiliscus. But whether Basiliscus was a traitor or not, the great expedition started well. Marcellinus ably seized Sicily and Sardinia from the Vandals. Heraclius's Egyptian army landed in Tripolis and began its march towards Carthage, largely unopposed. Meanwhile, the main fleet set sail for Sicily. One minor chronicler, Theophanes, suggests there was a naval battle off Sicily in which the Roman fleet triumphed over the Vandals. Quote, Basiliscus engaged in naval battles with Gaiseric's force and sank a great many of his ships, end quote. So far, so good for the Romans. Gaiseric must have been getting pretty worried. Probably in June 468, Basiliscus led the fleet from Sicily to North Africa. With a favourable wind, it may have taken only a day for it to reach the African coast. The great armada anchored in the shelter of a bay called Cape Bon, about 40 miles from Carthage, between Ras El Mar and Ras Adar in modern Tunisia. This place was no doubt chosen because the winds in summer were normally easterly and would help a quick descent on Carthage. Historians think Basiliscus was probably aiming to land his army at the Bay of Utica, a short march from Carthage, since the harbour of Carthage was protected against enemy shipping by a chain. Gaiseric must have been getting truly desperate by now. The Eastern Roman armada was far more powerful than his own forces. Procopius said that if Basiliscus, quote, had undertaken to go straight for Carthage, he would have taken it at the first onset and reduced the Vandals to servitude without their even thinking of resistance, end quote. But it was not to be. Gaiseric was a cunning old fox. He wanted Basiliscus to believe that he'd given up hope and was about to surrender. So he sent a deputation asking for a 5-day truce, while in reality he prepared for war. Why, oh why, did Basiliscus fall for this old trick? Contemporaries and historians have universally labelled Basiliscus either an imbecile or a traitor. Procopius's anger with him leaps out from the pages of his history. He suspected Basiliscus was a traitor who accepted a bribe from the Vandal king. Quote, they say that Gaiseric also, without the knowledge of Basiliscus's army, sent quite a sum of gold and in fact purchased this truce, end quote. In exasperation, he says that Basiliscus fell into Gaiseric's trap for any of three reasons. One, he simply wanted Gaiseric's money. Two, as previously mentioned, he was in league with Aspar against the Emperor Leo and wanted the expedition to fail. Or three, he was just plain stupid. My sense is that Basiliscus was naive enough to think Gaiseric really was about to surrender. Maybe he thought there was simply no way out for the Vandal king. But if there's one lesson to be learnt from 5th century Roman history, it is never to underestimate King Gaiseric. For by offering the truce, he was waiting literally for the wind of fortune to change. And the wind in question was an easterly one that would have propelled the Romans forward to Carthage and made it difficult for the Vandals to resist them. Gaiseric was waiting and hoping that the wind would change to a northwesterly that would pin the Romans to the coastline and allow him to launch his attack. And his attack was no ordinary assault on the vastly superior Roman fleet. He was going to use fire ships. Procopius wrote, quote, arming all his subjects in the best way he could, he filled his ships, but not all of them, for some he kept in readiness empty, and they were the ships which sailed most swiftly, end quote. Fortune can be fickle. Rome had had its fair share of good luck during the centuries of its rise to greatness, but in the years of its decline, its luck ran out. And there's no better example of this than what followed next, as Procopius described for us. Quote, but the Vandals, as soon as the wind had arisen for them, which they'd been expecting during the time they lay at rest, raised their sails and taking in tow the boats, which, as stated above, had been made ready with no men in them, they sailed against the enemy. And when they came near, they set fire to the boats which they were towing, when their sails were bellied by the wind, and let them go against the Roman fleet. And since there was a great number of ships there, these boats easily spread fire wherever they struck, and were themselves readily destroyed, together with those with which they came into contact. And as the fire advanced in this way, the Roman fleet was filled with dread, as was natural, and with a great shouting that rivaled the noise caused by the wind and the roaring of the flames, as the soldiers, together with the sailors, shouted orders to one another and pushed off with their poles the fireboats and their own ships as well, which were being destroyed by one another in complete chaos. End quote. Fire ships could be deadly in ancient warfare. Fire was one of the gravest threats to ancient wooden ships, whose sun-dried decks and sails burned quickly. Ironically, it was the Carthaginians, Rome's greatest enemy in its early days and the predecessors to the Vandal kingdom of Carthage, who'd used fire ships to devastating effect against a Roman fleet 600 years before in 149 BC. Centuries later, the Byzantines would learn to use Greek fire to destroy several enemy fleets. And a more modern example was the English defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588. There, the situation looked as hopeless for the English as it had done for the Vandals. The vast Spanish fleet outnumbered the small English navy, yet only 8 fire ships launched by the English against the Spanish sufficed to cause enough damage to disperse and defeat the entire Spanish fleet. And that was exactly what happened to the Romans at the Battle of Cape Bon in 468. We don't know how many Roman ships were burned and sank. We don't know how many Vandal fireships were released into the midst of the vast Roman fleet. All we know is that Procopius says the Vandals destroyed the Roman fleet in a fiery haze. He ends his description by praising the bravery of many of the Roman soldiers and sailors who fought desperately to prevent the fires from spreading while they also tried to fight the Vandal ships. Although Basiliscus survived the battle, he describes a Roman general named John who went down with his ship rather than surrender. Quote, John stood on the deck and turning from side to side kept killing very great numbers of the enemy, and when he realized there was no hope left, he jumped, wearing his heavy armor, from the deck into the sea, uttering that he would never surrender to the barbarian dogs. End quote. In just a few hours, the Vandal fireships had changed the course of history. The wily Gaiseric had won by far his greatest victory. Back in Italy, Ricimer smiled. He'd stopped what ships the Western Empire had from participating in the expedition. Fearful of Marcellinus, who was still in Sicily, he plotted his assassination. Shortly after the destruction of the Roman fleet, one of Marcellinus's officers stabbed him to death. Although Ricimer escaped prosecution for this treacherous act, historians universally regard him as the instigator. Meanwhile, Basiliscus returned to Constantinople. Fearing for his life, he took sanctuary in the church of Saint Sophia. There, his sister Verena, Leo's wife, intervened to protect him, although he'd been responsible for one of the Roman Empire's worst defeats in its entire history. He survived, and we'll hear more about him in years to come. But the Western Empire was not so lucky. Within just 8 years, it would cease to exist. And that ends this episode. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. And in the next episode, we'll hear about the final end of the Western Empire. And in the meantime, please do check out my new book, The Fall of Rome. And if you want a free ebook, please visit my new website at nickholmesauthor.com, where you'll find my first book called The Byzantine World War, about the decline of the Byzantine Empire and the start of the Crusades. If you like this podcast, I guarantee you'll like the book. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.